So the reading today is from Isaiah 53, beginning at verse 1, and that's on page 742 of the Church Bibles. So Isaiah 53, beginning from verse 1. Who has believed what they heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant, and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hide their faces. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his stripes we are healed. All we, like sheep, have gone astray and have turned everyone to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of my people? And they made his grave with the wicked and with the rich man in his death, although he had done no violence, and there was no deceit in his mouth.
Phil, thank you very much indeed, and good afternoon, everybody. Could you make sure you could keep that passage of the Bible open? That would be a big help to us all, I think. Isaiah chapter 53, page 742, and I think there's an outline as well on the bit of paper you were given as you came in. As Dagi said, we're spending these three Thursdays in the run-up to Easter poring over the details of this very famous chapter from Isaiah, because even though it was written 700 years before Jesus himself came to earth, I think it speaks more clearly, perhaps, than any other chapter of the Bible in explaining to us the reality, the significance, the brutality of the death of Jesus. I remember talking to a great old Christian man. At the time, I was going through a bit of a wobble in the Christian life, I think, and I was worried that I wouldn't last the course as a Christian. And because he'd been following Jesus for about three times longer than I'd been alive, I thought this was the bloke to go to ask, how is it that I last the course? So that was the question. How do I make sure that I keep going and that when I die, I'm more keen than I am today? The whole of the pressure from the world around me tells me to... It's okay to believe in Jesus, but I have to do it in a very private and not too zealous kind of way. So how do I make sure that Jesus means more and more to me as my life goes by rather than less and less? And I suppose there's any number of things that he could have said. There's no one right answer to that question. He could have told me to read my Bible. He could have told me to say my prayers. But I love what he did say, because what he said, I think, gets even closer to the heart of everything than that. He said simply, stay close to the cross of Jesus. You may remember that time when a woman of the night came to Jesus in Luke's gospel while he's eating dinner. And Luke says, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears. And then she wiped his feet with the hair of her head, and she kissed his feet and poured ointment over them. And others are objecting to the extravagance of the gesture. But Jesus commends the woman and explains it like this. The one who has been forgiven much loves much. And I think that's probably where the old man got it from. You want to continue, you want to grow in love for God, for Jesus Christ, in your commitment to going his way in the world. Well, the way to do it is to come back day by day and be reminded of the size of my debt before God. And then I will be motivated to love him, the debt that's been cleared by the death of Jesus. John Newton has been quoted here before. At the end of his life, two things I know, he said, that I am a great sinner and that Christ is a great saviour. So someone asks, look, I live in a city that is hostile to God. My friends are apathetic to him. My family, maybe even my husband, they don't share my faith. How do I last the course? Well, here's some prescription for you. Why don't we spend each day between now and Easter reading over Isaiah chapter 53. It's one of the things I'm hoping we'll be motivated to do through these Thursday lunchtimes. Reading it day by day, and each day trying to find just a different thing about the death of Jesus for which to give God thanks. I said last week, this fourth servant song, as it's called here in Isaiah, is structured like a great big sandwich. All of it comes in blocks of three verses, and the first match the fifth, the second and the fourth, and they push us in towards the verses we'll look at next week, verses 4 and 6, which means that today we're on the paragraph immediately to either side, as you'll see on the outline there, 1 to 3 and 7 to 9. And you'll see that as throughout the song, there's an enormous contrast between the way that we treat the servant, ultimately Jesus, and the way that he treats us. You'll see that first. What we did was we failed to esteem the servant. Verse 1 then. Who has believed what they heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Okay, so the prophet Isaiah is speaking. And at this point, he's speaking on behalf of the repentant people of God, the people who are committed to going God's way. And they are despairing together because nobody is believing the message that they are telling to the world about this great servant of God. And no one seems to get it, they say. No one seems to believe. And that's a familiar pattern in the Bible. In fact, this very verse is quoted twice in the New Testament. The first time with particular reference to the ministry of Jesus, and then the second time with particular reference to the ministry of the Apostle Paul. And on both occasions, it's saying both men found that no matter how well they preached, no matter how good their arguments, you get to be a better preacher than God himself. He knew his subject pretty well. He was able to communicate it pretty well. He knew his audience pretty well. And yet, no matter how well he preached, or anyone else, how many believed? Answer, not many. Not many. Well, why is that? Why is it that so few people believe what Christians know to be the very best news in the world? Verses 2 and 3 answer the question. For he grew up before him, before God, like a young plant and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. You'll see his humble beginnings to start with. Verse 2 again, he grew up before God like a young plant and like a root out of dry ground. Of course, with the eyes of faith, there was plenty in Jesus' birth to get excited about. The star in the sky, the angels singing, the shepherds visiting, the wise men worshipping. But to most, the whole thing was distinctly unimpressive. Just like a little root you might see growing up in the corner of the garden somewhere. There was a feeding trough in a borrowed stable. There was doubt about the identity of Dad. King Herod was campaigning for his death. It was all very inauspicious. Surely this isn't what it's going to look like when God himself comes to earth as the servant, when God comes to transform, as we thought last week, this decadent and sinful Jerusalem into this glorious new heavenly Zion. Surely it's going to look better than a feeding trough in a stable. As Jesus' life went on, people asked, can anything good come out of Nazareth? They said, he's the carpenter's son, but his mother's name's Mary. And so they took offense at him. They stumbled over him. You'll see, too, his common appearance. Verse 2 again, he had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. One commentator has a lovely phrase. He says that our eyes are caught and satisfied by superficial splendor. I think that's so telling. It's true in politics, isn't it? It's true in the whole world of celebrity. But God's servant Jesus didn't have the X factor. No particular dynamic charisma. Nothing on the outside, at least, to suggest that he was the great one. As a result, that commentator carries on, our eyes flicker across him in the crowd, and we do not even see him. Verse 3 puts it even more strongly. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. And so it was that Jew and Gentile alike had no time for him. Even his closest friends peeled away as his death approached. You may remember Peter in Matthew's Gospel. He began to invoke a curse upon himself and to swear, I do not even know the man. And still today, Jesus is despised. The verb means they consider him worthless. They deem him unworthy of attention. Let me ask, is that not modern London? It's certainly the way it is with most of my friends. It's not by and large that people have considered the claims of Jesus, weighed them up very seriously, and then decided that Christianity is not for them. By and large, it's that they haven't even been bothered to look at him. But the real sting in the tale is there in the last four or five words of verse 3, where Isaiah says, and we esteemed him not. You remember Isaiah is speaking on behalf of the repentant people of God, and he's saying, we esteemed him not. It's not just that the world is wrong about Jesus, it's that we used to be wrong about him as well. Apparently when J.K. Rowling first had the idea for Harry Potter, she was turned down by 8 publishers. Think of it now, they must be so sick, mustn't they? 8 publishers before Bloomsbury decided to give her a try. Well, there's a bloke called Dick Rowe, who was the guy at Decca Records, who decided against giving a recording contract to a new pop band from Liverpool called The Beatles. Even better, he's supposed to have turned around to the group's manager, Mr. Epstein, and said, terribly sorry, sir, but guitar groups are very definitely on the way out. There's no future for your band. You'll know that people go down in history for failing to spot the genius before their eyes. And Isaiah says, well, we Christians, we used to be wrong about Jesus Christ as well. Maybe some of us can remember a time in our life when we despised him in a very... maybe it was a very polite and respectable and religious sort of way. Maybe others can remember how they did it much more noisily and much more aggressively. What is certainly true for all of us is that if God had not chosen to open our eyes, to reveal his arm to us, as it says in verse 1 there, then the hidden beauty, if he'd not chosen to enable us to see the hidden beauty of the sun, well, we would still be wandering around in spiritual darkness. Which tells you everything about us, rather than anything about Jesus. Listen to some words from Alec Matir, another commentator on Isaiah. If you see the servant and you find no beauty in him, it reveals the bankruptcy of the human emotions. To be one with those who despise and then reject him exposes the misguidedness of the human will. To appraise him and conclude that he is nothing condemns our minds as corrupted by and participants in our sinfulness. Nothing but divine revelation can make the servant known to us and draw us to him. I love the way he pulls the different bits of the human being together, the emotions, the mind, the will. If we don't get Jesus, it tells you everything there is to know about us. And so it is very humbling, I think, to remember that that any value that Jesus has had in your life or mine in the last week, any love that there's been for him in our hearts, any esteem for him, any service of him, any trust in him as the means by which we can know God, any of that, all of it, is only by his grace. It's not from us. It's just from him. By nature, we are those who wouldn't even give Jesus a second look if he came and stood amongst us now. That's what we did. We, apart from God's work in us, we esteemed him not. Which I think makes absolutely breathtaking the thing that the servant chose to do next. Verse 7. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. You see the injustice of his treatment. As you read the verses, you have to ask, what has this servant done to deserve this sort of barbaric treatment? And the answer is nothing. Nothing at all. See it there in verse 9? He had done no violence. There was no deceit in his mouth. And so there's a contrast here between God's people and the servant. Because when God's people are oppressed in the book of Isaiah, it's oppression that they have brought upon themselves by virtue of their rebellion against God. When they are afflicted, it is because they deserve it. But that's not how it works with a servant. Everything about him is innocent. And yet still he's treated in this way. Can't help but think of Jesus. The first time he came before him in Luke's gospel, Pilate said of Jesus, I find no guilt in this man. Second time, he said to the chief priests after examining him, behold, I do not find this man guilty of any of your charges against him. Neither did Herod. Look, nothing deserving death has been done by him. Still they shouted, crucify him, crucify him. And so a third time Pilate said to them, why? What evil has he done? I have found in him no guilt. But they were urgent, Luke writes, demanding that he should be crucified. And their voices prevailed. Jesus didn't deserve to die. He was a victim of oppression and injustice. And the question of verse 8 is, who considered that? Who cared? Who even gave it a second thought? Not many. Not many. And yet still, Jesus didn't pull back from the brink. Verse 7, the example of his silence. He was oppressed, he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that's before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. Yeah, this servant was unjustly oppressed, but even so, he submitted himself willingly to his treatment, and he didn't open his mouth. I don't really understand the sheep thing. We don't do much countryside in my family. We need William here, really. I'm sure he'd be able to give us the blow-by-blow details of what a sheep does. But apparently, when you take a sheep to get its hair chopped off, if that's what you call it, they don't make a sound. Very often, they stay completely silent. Even when you take them to the slaughter, the sheep remains silent. And so it was with Jesus, walking humbly, freely, deliberately, steadfastly, silently to his death. He says, no one takes my life from me, but I choose to lay it down of my own accord. It's amazing this about Jesus. They mocked him. They reviled him. But never once did he insult them back. Do you find it hard to keep your cool? I think the older I get, I'm finding it harder and harder. On the phone to customer services, sometimes sadly with the children, when someone in the drives badly in front of me on the road. They murdered Jesus for no reason. And still, not even once did he curse them under his breath. He made no threats. He didn't even fix a soldier in the eye and say, you will pay for what you're doing. Instead, he prayed for them. He prayed for them. And Peter says he continued to entrust himself to the one who judges justly. And as Peter tells us that, it's not just that we're meant to wonder at Jesus, although I think we are. It's that we're meant to imitate him. This humble, submissive, non-violent, non-retaliatory way in which Jesus went to his death is for Christians the example, the model of how we are to respond when any unjust suffering comes our way. To this you've been called, says Peter, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you might follow in his steps. It may just be coincidence. Some of you have told me recently about hard times that you're having with your boss. Now, I said that on Tuesday, and immediately one boss turned and looked at the bloke next to him to see if he had a guilty conscience at the time. But people have been telling me about unreasonable demands, unfair appraisals, unprovoked attacks on the character, bullying, impossible deadlines, no resources to meet them. Let me say, Jesus knows the temptation to lash out with his tongue, to walk out the room, to fire off the email. Do you not think he was tempted to rain down fire from heaven on the lot of them and walk off into the sunset to live happily ever after? Peter says, let the example of Jesus in his death be the pattern that you follow in life. Like a lamb, he went to be slaughtered, and he did not even open his mouth. And he went through all of it for you, if you're someone who trusts in him. History tells the story of an Arminian prince who was taken captive along with his wife by Cyrus, the king of Persia. But in a spirit of generosity one day, we don't quite know why, Cyrus the prince called the guy in and asked him if he would like to have his liberty and his kingdom and his wife restored to him. To which the prince said, as for my liberty and my kingdom, I care not. But if my own blood could redeem my wife, I would gladly give it. Cyrus decided to give him all three. And so there they were, back in the palace, I guess, and the prince asked his wife what she'd made of King Cyrus. She said, I really didn't pay him much regard. My mind was so occupied with the man who offered to give his life as a ransom for me that I could think of no other. I wonder if that's how you feel about the cross of Jesus Christ. There's a painting by the pre-Raphaelite artist Sir Frank Dixie called The Symbol, which features a group of very highly dressed men and women wandering through an archway. The main character is a man who's standing very tall, very superior, looking down his nose at a bedraggled salesman by the side of the road. But the salesman is holding in his hand a little silver cross. And it's very clever because everything about the painting draws your eyes away from the cross and onto other things. So someone's reaching up to pluck an orange off a tree and your eye is drawn up there. Someone else is fiddling with a necklace, a chain around a man's neck, and your eye is drawn to what it's looking at. And Dixie gives the subtitle to the painting. It's a verse from Lamentations in the Old Testament. Is it nothing to you, all you who pass by? He painted the death of Jesus a lot. He seems to be saying, it's all very well to be rich and successful and beautiful, but does it really mean nothing to you that an innocent man should die in this way and do it willingly? The Christian says, there was a time when I failed to esteem the servant, but no longer. It's not that the cross is no longer nothing to me. Actually, it's my everything. You'll see why. It's a death that removes our guilt before God. It's a death that secures our eternal future in God's new heaven and new earth, the city, the home of righteousness, Zion itself. It's a death, says Isaiah in the next chapter, that means the steadfast love of the Lord will never depart from us. It's a death that secures boundless blessing for his people. And wonderfully at the same time, extends this glorious invitation to all of the nations of the world. Flick over a page with me in Isaiah to chapter 55 as we close. It's Isaiah's application, I think. Chapter 55, verse 1. How do I respond to this servant in his death? Come. Chapter 55, verse 1. Come, everyone who thirsts. Come to the waters. He who has no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without price. Spiritually, you're hungry, you're thirsty, you're poor. You've got no money. Come anyway and feast. Carries on in verse 6. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Lord that he may have compassion on him, and to our God that he will abundantly pardon. It's a glorious phrase, isn't it? And not a stingy dishing out of just a little bit of pardon, but the abundant pardon that we so desperately need. I wonder if you'll return to the Lord like that, if you haven't done so already. Well, in just a minute or so's time, I think we'll start our question time. I forgot to mention it at the start. If you're with us for the first time today, it's our pattern to take questions that you can scribble down on the question slip that's just in front of you, and we'll try and tackle those for a couple of minutes. We'll be done by 10 to 2, so if you've got to be back somewhere for a 2 o'clock meeting or something, we'll be done in plenty of time for that. So 30 seconds, I think stewards will bring some coffee to you on your tables, and then I'll get back up and try and deal with any questions that you've handed in at that point. We might try and work through a couple of these questions. They're very good, and some of them I haven't thought about much before, to be honest with you, so we'll see how we get on. This one I have. Jews say that Isaiah was talking about... Thank you. Jews say that Isaiah was talking about their nation in chapter 53. Why is a Christian interpretation correct? A little bit like it. How familiar would the Jews at the time be that God was going to send a servant like Jesus? Thank you. I'll do with the first one first. We said last week that chapter 53 cannot be talking about the nation of Israel because the servant seems to be one who is distinct from the nation of Israel. So in verse 9, for example, if you glance down at the verse, he did no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. Isaiah opens, if you remember, with a vicious attack upon Jerusalem itself, upon the nation of Israel, for being so far from God in their hearts, for becoming whereas once she'd been his bride, he describes her as being like a whore, a spiritual harlot. Her city is full of murderers, is the home of injustice. So God, through Isaiah, is giving a verdict on Jerusalem, on the whole of Israel, which is pretty damning. And yet here, the servant is one who's described as being innocent, perfect. They can't be the same one. And again, we said last week that the death of servants seems to be dealing with the rebellion and the wrongdoing of the nation of Israel. And so if all of the guilt of the repentant people of God is being laid on the servant who is innocent, he needs necessarily to be distinct from that people. And then certainly if it means anything to me, the fact that the New Testament writers refer to Jesus as being the one about whom Isaiah 53 was written, that should seal the deal for me, I think. But I think there is evidence within the passage itself, and then certainly in the way that it was understood in the first century by the earliest Christians, to say that it was about Jesus. Related to that, what evidence is there that this piece of Isaiah is written before Jesus came? I was trying to think in my head, and maybe someone will be able to shout one out, of a place where one of the later prophets quotes from the prophet Isaiah. Anyone know one? I didn't either. Isn't that bad? You sort of think you go to theological college, you might remember some of these. Well, you don't just have to say any prophet that comes into your head, Daph, just to try and impress us all. If you can find one, then let us know. But don't just say, was it Malachi? It may have been. That's the question. That's the whole point of what we're trying to work out. But what we do know is that the canon of the Old Testament scripture was settled several hundred years before Jesus came and included within it the book of Isaiah. Have you got it? No. Oh. Got it. Never mind. If you can think of one, let me know. It would be great to know. But the canon was absolutely settled hundreds of years before Jesus came and is referred to in many other pre-Christian documents around the place. So I think I don't know of a single scholar actually who would suggest that this stuff was written after Jesus came, trying to read that back into some Old Testament prophecy. I don't think there's any evidence for that at all. Here's a question. I talked about the innocence of Jesus. Wasn't he unreasonably angry when he cursed the fig tree in Mark 11, or possibly when he dealt with the merchants or dealers or money changers in John 2? And I guess any of the temple cleansings in the Gospels you could turn to and say, isn't he being unreasonable at that moment? Absolutely not. What we're not saying is that Jesus never got angry. What we're saying is that in his anger, he never sinned. So some anger in the world is a good thing. If you want to use the phrase instead, something like righteous indignation at evil is a very good thing. If God were not angry at the injustice and evil that we see in our world, that would be an awful thing. It's a good thing that he gets angry. And so when Jesus came to the temple in the first century and saw that what should have been a house of prayer, what should have been a place where the good news of God was being preached to all of the nations of the world, was instead being turned into some den for profit, well, he was right to get angry. And so he was right to flip over the tables and to demand that they clear up their act, as he pointed to the judgment of God that was about to fall on the whole Jewish religious system because of its failure to receive the Messiah when he came. So his anger was righteous and justified. And that's what sets it apart from so much of ours. So we have... and so often it's just pride, isn't it? What makes you raise your voice? So you feel as though you've been slighted in some way. You feel as though you haven't got your way. Your agenda isn't being followed by everybody else. You're not the center of the universe. And so we get upset and we throw our toys out of the pram. That's not what went on with Jesus. His was a righteous indignation at the evil and the evil religion that he saw around him. Does the Bible say why such an insignificant man was chosen? Another question, why did he not dazzle us with his coming, but chose humble beginnings? They're really good questions. I think, and not something I've thought about much before, what we do know is that it's the way that God chose to do it, and therefore it was the right way to do it. What we know is that God's pattern in life and throughout history has been to work through unexpected means to demonstrate that he is the one who is powerful and in control and acting in the world. So very often in the Old Testament, he'll take barren women and give them children as demonstration of kind of his power and the fact that the salvation that is being modeled is coming from him. I think as well, I may need to just caveat what I've said slightly in the sense that it's not that Jesus was unimpressive or that there was nothing brilliant about him. It's that what tends to impress us in life was not typical of him. So the people that get a following in our world are very, very beautiful people because superficial beauty attracts our attention. The people that get a following in the world are people with huge dynamic charisma, because that's what captivates our minds. But Jesus was different to that. It's not that he was unworthy of our allegiance. But it is that he deliberately set himself apart from the kind of leadership and influence that our world chases, and instead chose to be a servant. So it's not that he's unimpressive, it's that we look for the wrong kind of things. And if only we'd looked at him rightly, well, we would have been on our knees worshipping him rather than nailing him to a cross. I'm afraid I haven't been able to deal with all of the questions that came in. Apologies for that. Come and grab me afterwards if you want to follow up on anything. Shall I pray? And then we'll wander off. Our great God, we do confess that without your help, we would never see how wonderful Jesus is. We thank you for his innate excellencies, for the character of perfection that he exhibited at every stage of his life. Thank you for his humility, for the things that should attract us. And we're sorry that so often we chase after other things because we fail to appreciate him in all of his glory. And we praise you that though we didn't esteem him, he was willing to come and to die that we might live. And we pray this Easter that you might help us to respond rightly to the death of Jesus, to trust in him and him alone, and to be with those who worship him, for Jesus' sake. Amen.